Our final speaker of the night, Mr. Lucian Greaves. His speech title is The Satanic Plot to Dismantle Evangelical Theocratic Agenda. Lucian Greaves is a social activist, as well as the co-founder of the Satanic Temple, which aims to promote separation of church and state and empathy for all people. Let's give it up for Lucian Greaves.
Happy to see you all here. I didn't know what turnout would be due to the coronavirus scare, and I've been checking my updates every day to see if my events will be canceled. We have a rally in Utah coming up in April. We don't know if that'll be shut down. South by Southwest just shut down for fear of spreading the virus. Everybody's kind of looking to Coachella now. I have a lot of other kind of public events, and we don't know how this will impact the rest of the year. And I've been watching this as it plays out and been seeing the news, and I get irritated to see this commentary about this kind of dismissive commentary we were seeing at first about how, remember how the media scared us into thinking we were all going to die from SARS or MERS or any of those other things. Well, those weren't just media scares. These were things that were brought to a halt from a lot of hard work and a lot of real effort to contain these problems and make sure they didn't spread any further. And they were well worth the panic people may have felt at the time to rein it in. And I feel like we're dealing with something similar when it comes to the threat of the theocratic agenda, where people have become inured to the efforts of the evangelical movement within our government to dismantle democracy and take over the United States. And they now think that any time we fight these battles that we do, that they're merely symbolic or that they're merely a bit of pranksterism, and that really this is an ongoing battle and things don't really change, but they do. And one day we're going to wake up in a full-on theocracy and wish we had done more. And I think it's very similar to this coronavirus situation where we didn't learn anything from SARS. Everybody just seemed to think it magically went away, that the panic was manufactured, that it was a media event, when in reality there was a lot of work to be done. There was a lot of things we could have done to prevent the coronavirus from happening, from shutting down the wild animal market in Asia and building up a more robust response team within the CDC. Trump's first, one of his first agendas coming in was to cut some of that networking of disease prevention and control. And I'm hoping now that some people think a bit more circumspect about what it means to actually have an adult in office running things in a competent and reasonable manner rather than voting for somebody because they really piss off those liberals that irritate them. A little more than a month ago, I was in Scottsdale on trial for one of the cases we had going against City Council in Scottsdale. It was actually litigated in a federal court in Phoenix. And our chapter there had applied to give an invocation before a City Council meeting. The City Council in Scottsdale allows for invocations at the beginning of their meetings, and they're usually all Christian. They had no standards in place for who they would allow to speak, but the Greece versus Galloway decision in the Supreme Court in 2013, I think it was, stated that it was perfectly legal to have religious invocations preceding public meetings, but you absolutely could not discriminate based upon viewpoint. Of course, the evangelicals ran with that as just an affirmation that they're allowed to have exclusive privilege in the forum, and now they try to find ways to keep everybody else out. And this has been a big fight. Atheist groups have always been trying to give their invocations. People have tried delivering different types of rhetoric, and people are trying to think of the limits of what kind of haranguing they're going to allow on the public forum. But not often enough do they consider just shutting down and getting to the business of running their cities. In any case, we were first given permission to give the invocation. We were put on the schedule. Our chapter applied, said the Satanic Temple wants to give an invocation, and Scottsdale said, okay, we'll put you on the schedule. Later on, it came to media attention that this was going to happen, and there was an uproar. And it turns out, from a Freedom of Information Act request, we learned that some church group sent somewhere around 17,000 emails to the City Council exercising what's known as the heckler's veto. And we could see from emails exchanged within the city council that there was commentary being made by one council member who said that the idea of Satanists giving an invocation was equality gone too far. And the mayor of Scottsdale, this is from his from a flyer he sent out propagandizing his campaign, and it's kind of hard to see, it's a blurred photo, but one of the things he ran on was that he had stopped Satanists from mocking City Hall traditions with a prayer. They had no idea what we were even going to say in the minute and a half we were allotted, and infuriatingly, they tried to use that in their favor in the courtroom by saying that we never bothered to tell them what we were going to say in the course of our invocation, even though they had never asked. Irritatingly, also, the news, and this was a local Fox report, had picked up some of the talking points of the city. Michelle Short was the name of the chapter head of our Arizona chapter at the time. She was the one who was going to deliver the invocation. And in a news report during the trial, it said Short admitted that during cross-examination that she had not been a member of the Scottsdale community. She also admitted she had never contacted anyone within the city, any representative, about her beliefs and what type of invocation she was wanting to give. But then again, as I said, when they denied her, they hadn't asked these things. They had no standards in place that said, you need to give us the invocation in advance, or that you need to actually be a resident of Scottsdale. And in fact, we had members who were residents of Scottsdale, but because they didn't have that requirement, we just went with the chapter head who was a resident of Tucson. So in any case, the city argued also that we aren't a legitimate religious group. I didn't think we would have to deal with those arguments anymore, since in the past year we were affirmed by the IRS as a recognized federally tax-exempt church, explicitly non-theistic, but a religious organization just the same as recognized by the federal government. But still, this argument was brought up that we're not legitimately a religious organization, but that our sole intention was to mock other people's beliefs. And in fact, if they could find any instance in which we did any one thing, they would try to define that as mutually exclusive to being any other thing. So anytime we had engaged in mockery of a religious organization, that was evidence that that is all we do. Anytime we had anything to do with politics, it was pure evidence that we were merely political. Of course, you just don't see that mirror turned on the evangelical organizations that we're often opposed up against. So it's a great deal of hypocrisy. The outcome of the trial was one I honestly hadn't really expected. That I didn't expect either. But in any case, the judge affirmed our legitimacy as a religious organization, said that we are deserving of our religious status, and to discriminate against us would be a violation of our civil rights as a church organization. But in any case, he also ruled that we hadn't proven beyond some reasonable doubt that we were discriminated against, because the city council administrator said that he had not considered any of these comments by the city council when considering whether to allow us to speak or not. And the fact that they only made up a standard of close community ties after the fact to justify excluding us also didn't prove that we were discriminated against, only that the administrator himself thought that they had a long-standing tradition of requiring community ties, and then trying to post hoc apply something he made up on the spot to us in finding we didn't fit the criteria. How this decision made any sense is beyond me. It doesn't. But it does go to show that you can have as strong an argument as you could possibly get, and you can still lose in the courts. And that's no small matter at all when you consider that Donald Trump is putting a lot of federal judges into place right now who don't even know what the law is to begin with. And they're certainly not going to be inclined to rule in our favor. One thing it really does leave hanging, though, and leaves you to wonder if the judge was just trying to get it out of his courtroom, was how they would deny us again. The idea was is that they couldn't discriminate against us if we followed the standards and the protocols, but that we hadn't proven that they had done it this time. So, I mean, you can bet your ass we're going to apply again. We're just waiting to see if that would have any negative impact on our pending appeal right now. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out when they know that we've already been found to be a religious organization and that it would be discrimination to reject us on something that can be proven to not be an administrative error. But the city spent somewhere upward of $200,000 just fighting to keep us from delivering a minute and a half long invocation. And I don't know, that's a bit of absurdity, but the way that case turned out makes us wonder about how our other cases will turn out. I mean, we thought we really had a home run with Scottsdale, and it's disturbing it turned out that way. We have another case pending right now in Belle Plaine, Minnesota. And in fact, the missing slide here was a picture of a veterans memorial we had created for Belle Plaine to put on the public grounds, where they had put up a Christian Cross Veterans Memorial on the public grounds. It was actually put up by a citizen of the community and allowed to stay in this public park. And a local member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation complained. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation wrote a letter to the town and said, this is a violation of the separation of church and state. It needs to come down. And so they took it down. And then an organization known as the Alliance Defending Freedom, or the Alliance Defense Fund, they changed their name from one to another. I forget which way it went. But they're another one of those networked theocratic organizations that specializes in litigation. One of them flew out, they had a city council meeting, and they had this clever idea that if it wasn't government speech, but if it was a private donation, it wouldn't be a church-state violation. The idea would be that it was a limited public forum allowing for monuments to veterans within certain building criteria, but they couldn't discriminate based upon viewpoint. Freedom From Religion Foundation said, fine, and then I got a call from them directly, because they consider the Satanic Temple their nuclear option on these types of things. And they asked if we had anything, if we wanted to put this to the test. And in fact, we do have a lot of veteran members of the Satanic Temple, so it wasn't only about testing those boundaries of government viewpoint neutrality, but it was also about honoring the fact that there are veterans of many different viewpoints and beliefs and reasserting that pluralism there in their name. In any case, they approved our monument, Belle Plaine, and they let us go through the effort of spending some $30,000 to $40,000 having it constructed, paying for the materials, getting it all together, and then setting up the shipping of it, and we were going to do a dedication ceremony on the public grounds. And we were just trying to schedule when we would drop it off in Belle Plaine when the city decided that they were going to shut down the forum entirely. Some people were saying that was a win for us, but we really don't have the resources to be out that kind of expenditure each time a city decides they think they're calling our bluff. Obviously, they were just waiting to see if we would come through or if we would not, and I think there should be some repercussions for that, and I think those fuckers should pay us back. But I really don't know. I really don't know. If we could lose Scottsdale, I could see us losing this one too. But the way I see it, they really had a contractual obligation. They approved us for at least a year of having that monument sit there. We did not have it constructed until after their approval, and that's the way it was. But with that event, we did see what sociologists or scholars of religion will refer to sometimes as projective inversion, which is you blame your opponent for the things that you do. And at one point, a Catholic priest was giving commentary about our veterans' monument, and he was saying that this was going to be potentially harmful for children. In an article In the Gospel Herald, it said, the Satanic Temple's memorial to dead soldiers in Belle Plaine's Veterans Memorial Park in Minnesota could prompt young people to consider Satanism and reject good moral behavior, a priest has warned. The inverted pentagrams on the Satanic Monument proposed by the Satanic Temple will prompt young people to consider Satanism for themselves and to reject the good moral behavior required for an ordered and peaceful society, Father Brian Lynch of Our Lady of the Prairie in Belle Plaine warned in his address to the City Council on Monday, as reported by the Catholic Spirit. The priest also warned that the monument may also attract pre-existing Satanists to our community as a place for theistic, satanic ritual activities that victimize our children. He argued that this could lead to a form of grooming similar to that used by pedophiles. This is kind of a... Yeah. You can imagine him with clenched fists sweating and really having this intense fantasy about it all. This grooming is intended to not only make children afraid to report the abuse they suffer at the hands of Satanists, but also to feel personally responsible for the evil they have suffered as youthful victims, Lynch continued. Most disturbing is the fact that theistic satanic ritual activities are known to include deviant sexual acts with and among children. Yeah, you can't really make that up. I mean, I can really let it pass without commentary any further that was a Catholic priest saying these things. Anyways, more well-known amongst our campaigns to put monuments on public grounds next to complement and contrast monuments of another kind is our Ten Commandments campaign in Arkansas. We offered a monument of our own to go alongside a privately donated Ten Commandments monument that is now on the Arkansas Capitol grounds, which you may or may not realize. I'm not sure what people know about us, honestly. But the first time we fought this battle was in Oklahoma. And what was interesting is that in Oklahoma, the bill that was passed by the legislature and signed off on by the governor was almost the same verbatim as the bill. The ones in Oklahoma and Arkansas were almost the same verbatim. They're obviously coming from the same source. They would switch out Oklahoma for Arkansas and some other texts, but clearly the argument in many of the in the whole construction of the document was the same. This was model legislation. And the argument being that if it's a private donation on the public grounds, again, like in Belle Plaine, it's not an endorsement by government. And also the idea that this is just speaking to the codification of U.S. law, because the idea is that constitutional law was so inspired by the Ten Commandments that it's a part of our history and heritage. And you also see within the theocratic movement the use of these kinds of key words like history and heritage. And you can see Brett Kavanaugh using it a lot prior to his confirmation to kind of signal to his base that he was going to fight these battles. And I feel like we have a real losing shot now when it comes to bringing our fights all the way to the Supreme Court. I still think we really have a strong case in Arkansas. I do think we'll win the Arkansas case. It will definitely be appealed, though, and I can see it being a grave injustice if it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. In Oklahoma, it didn't get that far. It didn't come to us going to trial. The ACLU was already litigating against the Ten Commandments monument on the Oklahoma Capitol grounds, and the Oklahoma State Supreme Court deemed it illegal and had it taken down based upon a separation of church and state statute of the Constitution of the state of Oklahoma. The state of Arkansas, I think their statute is even stronger than the one in Oklahoma. Article 2, Section 24 says, in relevant part, at the end, it's a little dark, it says, no preference shall ever be given by law to any religious establishment, denomination, or mode of worship above any other. Well, what you're missing there is the governor of Oklahoma, Mary Phelan, after the Oklahoma Supreme Court deemed the Ten Commandments monument illegal and asked for it to be taken down, she tweeted, verbatim, The people of Oklahoma should be able to vote on whether to bring the Ten Commandments monument back to the Capitol, showing that the governor herself didn't understand the mechanics of law that she was commenting upon, and neither did the Attorney General, Scott Pruitt, who is really a deeply disturbed dumb shit who was appointed by Trump afterwards to be the head of the EPA. This was also echoed by Scott Pruitt. And Scott Pruitt, as the Attorney General, even went so far to tweet things suggesting that the Supreme Court justices in Oklahoma need to be replaced, which was a grossly irresponsible thing for an Attorney General to do. In the case of Arkansas, the sponsor of the Ten Commandments bill, Senator Jason Raypert, is much more vocal than the sponsor of the bill was in Oklahoma. The sponsor of the bill in Oklahoma was also a pastor, like Jason Raypert is, but really kept a low profile and refused to debate me. If anybody's seen Hail Satan, you can see that Jason Raypert, I really love this guy, is like my nemesis, because he always rises to the bait. You know, I can talk shit at him on Twitter or whatever else, and he'll throw a temper tantrum. And it's really good for, you know, everybody pays attention, everybody loves it. They love to see this guy melt down. He regularly has tirades apropos of nothing as well, about abortion, gay marriage, and all those hot button topics that the theocrats really love to hammer on, because they really are able to generate a base of support on single issues. They can present somebody as the anti-abortion person. They know everybody will line up and they'll vote for them. People with more introspection, people who think a little harder, will all kind of like tear apart our candidates and be accused of putting them to the purity test because we care about multiple issues. And that's where we lose. They all line up on the voting day and they all vote for their person and they get them in. There's a shrinking minority. The evangelicals, the theocrats are a minority voice, but they've really managed to mobilize in this authoritarian fashion, and they've managed to really get people to rally behind them unquestioningly, and that's how they win. I mean, keep that in mind come election day. I'm not one to usually advocate for the lesser of two evils, but at this point, come on, there is no fucking around here. This is getting pretty desperate. Raypert, he runs this Holy Ghost Ministries, and on the one hand, he's always saying that he tries to make the legal argument, and sometimes publicly makes the legalistic argument that the Ten Commandments Monument is a private donation, that it's just part of history and heritage. But other times, he rants and raves, and there's a tactical benefit to me pissing him off online a lot of times. Is he'll be more candid sometimes when he gets irritated, and he'll talk about how I'm trying to take God out of the public square, by which I assume he means, and I think the court will agree, he means the Ten Commandments Monument. And on his Holy Ghost Ministries website, he has a picture of the Ten Commandments Monument with this text that talks about bringing the gospel into the public squares and the importance of having godly leaders. He is also, of course, a gun enthusiast. He tweeted one time about how it was somebody coming up to ask him a question in a parking lot was not smart to come up and harass somebody in a parking lot who's carrying a handgun. Better be glad you decided to walk away. Hashtag armed and ready. And you can see at the bottom, he considers the pride parades to be anti-Christian values parades. That's what a tender snowflake he is. Gay pride to him is just anti-Christian mockery.
Did nobody ever say anything about the fact that the word Sabbath is spelled wrong on the monument?
Yeah, everybody laughed at him, and they all threw a temper tantrum, and it was great fun for a little while there. But I had more tweets of his. I don't know why some of the slides disappeared. We did a little conversion to PowerPoint, but I mean, just look at his Twitter feed. The guy's loads of fun. If you've got a sick sense of humor and you're able to every so often. Laugh about that kind of witlessness, because you have to sometimes. But he's really quite open and forthright at times about bringing God into the public square, about bringing Christian values into the government. And to that end, he also created a group called the National Association of Christian Lawmakers. And I woke up with a little case of the frowns one day, and I was checking out the Twitter feed for the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, and saw they tweeted a poll where the question was, do you think we'd be better off if we had more Christian leaders in the United States? And because he's tweeting it out to his audience, it was like 70% yes, we need more Christian leaders, and then, you know, the rest were still no. But I was like, whoa, let's see about this. And I was with my friend Catherine Stewart. She just wrote a great book, Power Worshippers. You should check it out. You should buy it. It just came out last Tuesday. But I said, let's watch how long this takes. So I retweeted it without commentary on the Satanic Temple Twitter feed, which has more followers than his National Association of Christian Lawmakers, and my personal Twitter feed. And within a minute, it was up to like in the 90 percentiles, no. And of course, Raypert, being Raypert, threw a fit, and he started tweeting about how Satanists had hijacked his poll. And the best part about that was the next day, Huffington Post ran a piece, and a lot of outlets picked it up after that, and they didn't seem to realize that Satanists actually were responsible for this. And they were treating him as though he was a lunatic, saying, they're saying, look at this guy. He believes Satanists are to blame for the fact that people, you know, don't agree in his poll that more Christians should be running the United States. And infuriating him further was I didn't correct any of it. I was just retweeting these articles and tagging him in them, and I was saying, man, you look like a lunatic. What is the matter with you? And from that, like I said, tactically, I think we really did get some confessions from him about his agenda to help install a theocracy in the United States. Honestly, he did a Facebook Live feed, which he often does, and he started ranting about how I'm picking on him and all those things. And he's also desperately trying to get my legal name out there. In order to file these lawsuits, of course, I need to put my legal name on the paperwork. And I'm telling you, this guy wants me dead. And that's no bullshit. You know, there's no reason for him to be propagating my legal name. And when I went to Arkansas for his deposition, he decided to tweet the time, the place, and that I was going to be there. And he knows I'm under threat of death in Arkansas. That's just the nature of it. This is a state senator. It's the behavior of this guy. But the interesting thing about the deposition of Jason Raypert was that we were trying to interrogate him on the revision history of the bit of legislation that passed into law that allowed for the Ten Commandments monument to stand on the Capitol grounds, and he wouldn't answer to it. He claimed legislative immunity, which was a really kind of spurious argument, but we couldn't move past it. We have a motion in the court to compel discovery on this, saying it was a bullshit thing, but he just wouldn't answer the question. And I'll tell you what it is. He's he's chair of the Arkansas Division of the Congressional Prayer Caucus. And if you don't know who the Congressional Prayer Caucus are, they're part of the lead on Project Blitz. And how many of you have heard of Project Blitz? Well, for those of you who haven't, you should really look it up. Project Blitz, the playbook, wasn't released until after we started fighting these battles, after we could already tell that the things we were fighting state by state were actually part of a unified, well-networked, well-funded effort. These weren't popping up in their individual states as grassroots movements as they were being presented as. And to this day, Raypert likes to talk about outsiders coming from outside of Arkansas fighting against the greater will of what the Arkansas people want and deserve and have asked for, which isn't true at all. These bills are being penned somewhere else by other people, by the Congressional Prayer Caucus, and they're doing it all across the United States, and it's part of a larger effort to install a theocracy in the United States. They seem to have an omerta-like code of silence about it. They won't respond to it. They won't answer to it. There was a case in Ohio recently where they were trying to pass... There was a representative trying to pass a bill that would allow students to claim religious exemption from giving the proper answers on tests. They could give an answer that was religiously correct to them, say if it was a biology exam and they didn't want to believe in evolution or whatever else, and that they couldn't be marked down for that kind of thing. It turned out that it was model legislation from Project Blitz, and when Guardian hunted the representative down and asked him if he had heard of Project Blitz and if this was model legislation, he said he had no idea what it was, and it turned out that, like Jason Rapert, he had at one time been chair of the Ohio Congressional Prayer Caucus, so it's definitely something to look out for. This is the monument that we asked to put up alongside the Ten Commandments monument in Arkansas. And we actually put a lot of thought into the symbolism of this, and we put a lot of thought into the arguments that would be made so that they could directly parallel the arguments being made for the Ten Commandments monument. People often ask why we didn't have our seven tenets just printed on a slab, and it's because that's kind of antithetical to our beliefs about beliefs. One of our tenets states that our beliefs should be open to revision based upon the best available evidence. And for that matter, we don't believe in having fiats etched in stone. Things of a more symbolic structure like this, something more impactful and metaphorical, that resonates for us a lot more deeply. But just the same, we wanted something that would symbolize the kind of pluralism that we were advocating for. In the Baphomet, which is kind of taken from this 19th century occult historian's drawing of the Sabbatic goat, seemed to be a good embodiment of that, and that has these binary features. It's part animal, part human, points above and below, has the inverted pentagram behind and the right side up one on the forehead, the caduceus in the middle, symbolizing reconciliation and negotiation, and the children on either side looking up adoringly, and that really, really pissed some people off. And also, of course, it has that lap so you can sit on Baphomet's lap and take your picture and that type of thing. But we also were saying that this does speak to the codification of law and U.S. law, because we think it sends a more powerful message about basic fundamental constitutional freedoms than the Ten Commandments ever could. The Ten Commandments, of course, run very contrary to the First Amendment. Prohibitions against free speech in the way of anti-blasphemy proclamations, proclamations against freedom of religion, such as thou shalt have no gods before me, that type of thing. Of course, I fly out tomorrow morning for depositions in Arkansas this upcoming week, where the Arkansas Attorney General's office will ask me a bunch of questions and try to dissect me on these things, and I suspect they'll ask stupid questions like, well, what do you have against prohibitions against murder and adultery and things like that? And of course, I guess if you just took those out of context and in isolation, there's nothing wrong with them, but to put them alongside a demand that you must recognize the Sabbath, yeah, it is pretty insulting. That's certainly not what we base the Constitution off of, and nobody's being fooled by that. And it's also interesting to note that despite a federal judge recently in Arizona affirming our status as a religion and worthy of being recognized as a religious organization, and despite the fact that the IRS has recognized us as a religious organization fulfilling all of their criteria to be one, Arkansas still is trying to present reams of documentation delegitimizing us as a religious organization. That's, though, why I think we have such a strong case in Arkansas. For one thing, Rapert was too stupid to stick to the legalistic points he was supposed to be making. He's confessed to his theocratic intentions time and time again. And these questions about whether we're a religious organization or not are probably going to be considered resolved by any other federal judge who doesn't want to reverse now two decisions made by the federal government. It becomes a lot more difficult to do. And it just becomes far more difficult as time goes on, as our chapters keep growing and our numbers keep growing. And I keep encountering people more and more who really do take on the Satanic Temple's brand of Satanism as their religious identity, fully recognizing it as non-theistic and non-superstitious, but finding their sense of community with us. And it's been really gratifying for me to see how this has evolved, because it could have gone many different ways. There's only so much somebody like me in a leadership position can do to kind of author the course of a social movement like this. And in a lot of ways, I feel more like a sociologist watching it happen and seeing what's interesting to people and what people want to engage in and what they want to do. It's really interesting to me to see how much our chapters want to engage in ritual practices. And again, there's no superstition behind it. It's cathartic. A lot of this is community building. A lot of people felt alone and outcast in their communities before and found a community of misfits with us. And they're finding all of the elements of religion that they might have missed without the superstition, embracing that. And I think that, more than anything, ends up being really horrifying to our religious opposition as well, when they see that this is a real thing. And despite the fact that we don't hold any supernatural beliefs, we have all the power of religious coherence behind us, and all that benefit of a growing army of supporters. You may have also been aware that we have litigation pending in defense of reproductive rights. It started really, this really came on hard and heavy when Donald Trump came into office, and it emboldened a lot of lawmakers in different states to try to pass some of their pet bills, weasel bills, to make getting an abortion prohibitively difficult. And in many states, as soon as he was elected, they tried passing some of these laws, like this heartbeat bill. I think this one in particular was in Ohio. I don't quite remember. Utah, one of those fucking places. But the idea was that they wanted to pass a bill that said that so long as a heartbeat could be detected in the fetus, you couldn't you couldn't have the abortion. This is just kind of an arbitrary goalpost, and a lot of times the presence of a heartbeat comes earlier than the pregnant person even realizing that they're pregnant. We announced immediately that we would offer exemptions from that to our membership, because it ran contrary to our religious beliefs. In a press release, I said, "To us, the heartbeat is relevant to claim personhood. We do not advocate for a belief in the soul. Therefore, we feel that complex cerebral functions necessary for perception are what make a person a person. The non-viable fetus, a fetus that cannot survive outside the woman's body, is, we feel, a part of the woman's own body, and it is her choice whether or not she continues the pregnancy. Our tenets assert bodily autonomy and uphold science as the arbiter of claims over what is true, to which we give deference in our decisions. As the Ohio bill is imposed for no medical purpose and presents no compelling state interest, it is simply a violation of our free exercise. We will fight back against it, and we will very likely prevail." I like to say things like "we will very likely prevail," just in case it might fool some of the people pushing forward these bills, but in reality, I'm not that confident. And we see things like undue burden and the idea of compelling state interest being chipped away more and more as more and more weasel bills are introduced to try to make it difficult for women to get abortions. One, though, that I do think we really do have strong standing on is there has been several attempts now to pass these fetal burial bills. And in Texas, in this case, and it popped up again in Georgia. I mean, this is model legislation. This is probably being generated from the Congressional Prayer Caucus. Other groups like that, wall builders, they're all kind of financially networked together and networked in many other logistical ways. But in any case, you'll see these same types of bills being presented again and again. But the idea was that if you would get an abortion, there was going to be the added cost of some kind of proper burial. And of course, it had nothing to do with the dignity of the fetus, as they were saying, but it had everything to do with incurring more expenses with the procedure, and whether or not the clinic would have to pass that off to the people getting the procedure or not. They knew they were going to make getting the procedure more difficult for somebody, and hopefully make it harder overall to have it done. Fortunately for us, though, in our argument, burials have always been within the purview of religious belief. And I said in that press release, Texas health officials are boldly imposing the view that the fetal tissue is elevated to personhood, a religious opinion that conflicts with our own. If Texas is going to treat the disposal of fetal tissue differently from the disposal of any other biological material in contradiction to our own religious beliefs, they need to present a compelling state interest for doing so. You'll notice I'm always using this kind of terminology, compelling state interest. It's because that's the things the courts are looking for. The courts have determined that the states would need compelling state interest to impede on somebody's ability to get an abortion. They can't put an undue burden on a woman to get an abortion. So I try to present those arguments up front so that maybe to dissuade the people passing the bill or dissuade the governor from signing the bill into law, because maybe on some level they don't want to pass something into law that's deemed unconstitutional, or maybe I'm still living in the past. Of course, there is no state interest, and it's perfectly clear that the demand for fetal tissue burial is a punitive measure imposed by sadistic theocrats. It's clear that these officials deem harassment an acceptable form of pushing their misguided religious agendas. It's interesting to see how this plays out in some of the Catholic press and other things like that. I like this spin on it. Satanic Temple says humane treatment of aborted babies contradicts our fundamental beliefs. And you can also see some kind of crazy headlines as well, suggesting that our interest in reproductive rights comes from an age-old interest in satanic ritual infant murder. You'll see a lot of that float around as well. And of course, we get the argument sometimes that we're just provoking these people, that we should go about it another way. We're just kind of affirming their beliefs. But I think that kind of assumes that we don't have affirmative beliefs of our own and that we kind of arbitrarily pick the satanic metaphor, which isn't true. And I think if you have more kind of inquiries about that, maybe the film Hail Satan will help you out if you haven't seen it. Also, there was a big kind of push to tie us to Planned Parenthood, making this argument that we were working hand-in-hand with Planned Parenthood, or that we had some kind of formal arrangement with one another, which we don't. And, you know, the Washington Times is fairly big enough and prevalent enough that it goes beyond that kind of obscure Catholic press into something that you may not expect that kind of disingenuous, outright fabricated spin. But there it was. This article in particular was this kind of meandering piece that made kind of half allegations and in innuendos about this kind of nefarious tie Satanists have to Planned Parenthood. There's also some kind of guy who makes his living as claiming he's an ex-Satanist, who claims he used to work at Planned Parenthood or attend Planned Parenthood abortions, which were satanic rituals. His name is, fun fact. I reached out to that Catholic priest who was saying that the Belle Plaine Monument would provoke pedophilia. And I wrote him directly and I asked, where are you getting this shit? He's getting it from the same guy who claimed he was at Planned Parenthood doing satanic rituals during this. So anyways, the one lawsuit we actually have going in regards to reproductive rights is in Missouri against Missouri's informed consent law. We're on our second appeal with that right now because it's gotten thrown out more on procedural grounds with the judges refusing to look at the actual question. At first, our case was thrown out on the grounds that a member of ours had been pregnant. She was going to get the procedure done. We gave her an exemption from the informed consent criteria. And the informed consent criteria in Missouri states, you need to go to the clinic first. You need to receive this booklet, which you could just download online. They do, in fact, have it online. But you need to go to the clinic and get it first. And then wait 72 hours to ponder it. And especially the statement, the one statement that it's legislated that this booklet contained that says, the life of each human being begins at conception. Abortion will terminate the life of a separate, unique, living human being. So ostensibly, you're meant to understand this, ponder it for 72 hours, and then come back. Well, the problem with that, besides the obvious as well, is that was at the time when we pushed this lawsuit, one or two clinics that would perform abortions in Missouri. I think it's one now. But Missouri's a big enough state that could mean, you know, somebody could travel upwards of 6 hours to do this. A lot of women, unbeknownst to the people who fight against abortion, who seek abortions, already have children, are working, have to take time off work, maybe even get accommodations, find somebody to watch over their kids. In any case, they're just trying to make it more difficult to get an abortion. They're trying to make it financially prohibitive for people who, you know, probably don't have the finances to have another kid anyways, or have a kid at all. And it's just obviously one of those things that's trying to make abortion more difficult. And it has nothing to do with medically sound informed consent, which just tells people what the risks of a procedure really are. In fact, it's pretty insulting that this is called informed consent. Our argument, of course, is that we do not agree with the statement, in deference to our religious tenets, that the life of each human being begins at conception, and that abortion will terminate the life of a separate, unique, and living human being. We believe that the fetus is a part of the woman's own body, the non-viable fetus, and it is up to her whether she brings it to term or not. And being that, of course, as affirmed by the Hobby Lobby case, religious belief trumps scientific fact, which was a remarkable outcome of Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby was claiming that certain contraceptive pills were abortifacients when in fact they were not. And the Supreme Court declared it didn't matter that they were not. What mattered was that Hobby Lobby, as a religious conscious discrete entity, however that works, was supposed to have believed that these were abortifacients when they weren't. I feel like we have science on our side, but I also feel that the Hobby Lobby ruling prevents us from the burden of having to bring expert witnesses to argue the scientific point, which makes it a little bit cheaper for us, but not by much when you see how these things play out. And you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on litigation just to have a judge throw it out and say, well, because your plaintiff isn't pregnant anymore, the case is moot, which is what happened to us at first, which was not a legitimate ruling in our minds, because this was already kind of asked and answered during Roe versus Wade. The idea is capable of repetition, yet evading review. You're not supposed to do that, but the judge did anyways, and we paid the bill anyway, you know, and all we can do is appeal and keep going and see if we can finally get judges who are willing to look at the issue rather than nitpick standing, which is really what they do when they want to avoid the issue entirely. And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a situation in which we're recognized as a religious organization. Ostensibly, we have all the rights of somebody else, but it's just not going to happen. You know, they're going to find a way every time. Like in Scottsdale, it was kind of feeble. And like I said, now we can apply again, and I don't know how they'll deny us. But we're going to have that kind of nitpicking and hair splitting on standing that nobody else is going to have. And people are going to look down upon us when we lose these cases, and they're going to think we're failing and that we're doing something wrong. We're not. We're fighting this the best we can, and our lawyers are doing the best job they can. These are, you know, in some of these cases, we have lawyers who really believe in what we're doing, and it's still prohibitively expensive for us as an organization that doesn't make nearly the money the theocrats were up against. Their finances are somewhere in the hundreds of millions. But just keeping up with the costs alone, the filing fees and everything else, is just killing us. And yet these outcomes aren't putting much thought into it. But it's kind of funny to see the direction our opposition will take these things in. The Thomas More Society, which is an explicitly religious Catholic anti-abortion organization, at one point during our appeal process, put out a press release talking about glorifying themselves for filing an amicus brief with the court, which is a Friends of the Court brief, which weighs in on one side or the other and tries to persuade the judge to take one argument more seriously than the other. And in this case, of course, they were hilariously making the claim that this whole argument about abortion, man, it has nothing to do with religion. What are these Satanists talking about? You know, this is a scientific fact issue. And the scientific facts, of course, come in on the side of wherever they shift the goalposts to. You know, when does life begin? Well, whenever you have unique DNA. Forget about the fact that it can split off and become twins or triplets, and that this is more or less a blueprint, that there's no cerebral functions, that there's no actual perception involved. Unique DNA, that's all you need. Forget the fact that tumors have unique DNA, and we get rid of those. I mean, all those things aside, this all of a sudden is a scientific question. It's just ridiculous to say it's religious. The actual funny part about this, though, was they went on this whole public blitz about this this masterful amicus brief they were going to file, and then they were too late, and they didn't file it anyway. So, anyways, we did kind of get one win in Missouri, which is during oral arguments in the Missouri case, we were arguing against what looked to be a state mandate that the pregnant person get and listen to, observe an ultrasound during this 72-hour period. And the state argued that this was never mandatory, it was voluntary, the wording was vague, and that they never meant that a woman actually needed to get this ultrasound, and that they, you know, anybody could reject the ultrasound or turn it down. They didn't need to get it after all. That was considered a win in reproductive rights circles in Missouri. I don't know if people kept that in mind. I'm only hoping that the clinicians and the agents at Planned Parenthood have this in mind and let pregnant people know that they can resist this, and if they're told it's mandatory, that there's a precedent that says it isn't. And so it's kind of a small victory, and hopefully we'll have a bigger victory coming up, but in that case, I don't think so. Because the appeal went to a couple of Trump appointees who have a really bad track record on this kind of thing. And the stupider you get with administrations, and the Trump administration, these are some stupid people. And they don't care. They really don't care what the law is, and they really don't care, some of them, if they even look like they're trying to follow the law. It used to be a little easier in the way that if you could just if you could just make the cognitive dissonance too strong, you could maybe count on winning. But now you have them emboldened enough that I really think we're going to see, with all the appointments of federal judges, a real shift in the character of the United States for the worse, and we're going to be living the outcome of the Trump administration for much longer than Trump is in office. And, you know, not to be too fatalistic, but I think if he wins the next election, we're f***ed, to put it mildly.